So we're going to go on to the next case and get into the issue of management of myeloma in the transplant-eligible patient. I have to say, just to take a deep breath, thinking about this man, you know, deeply ill in the hospital with his wife at home with metastatic lung cancer, and the physician being able to return him to health in order to take care of his wife, really a compelling situation. It really struck me when I spoke with Dr. Schwartz. Let's talk about the next patient. Mari, this is a 54-year-old woman of Dr. Paul Fishkin from Illinois, right outside Chicago, who presents with pneumococcal sepsis and pancytopenia. You can see a SPEP and beta 2 microglobulin bone marrow. And she actually goes into the SWOG study, randomizing between RVD and RD. She gets randomized to RVD, Mari, and actually has a pretty hard time with it. A lot of neurotoxicity, hyponatremia, hypokalemia. She gets an ulcer in her leg, treatment delays, treatment stoppage. Finally, she gets through the whole thing as currently on maintenance lenalidomide. And here's Dr. Fishkin presenting a couple of questions to you and presenting the patient.
She's a clerk in the clinic at the local hospital where we go to. Her husband's a farmer, and you know, like a lot of people in Illinois, she's a fairly stoic individual. It doesn't complain a lot. She's very warm and engaging, very pleasant, not at all difficult to work with, favorite of the nursing staff. This is the first patient I've ever given RVD to, and she had, I thought, was quite a bit of neurological toxicity, much more so than I would typically expect. And she had a lot of fatigue, a lot of tiredness, a lot of painful neuropathy. She was dose-reduced per study at least two times, and then finally taken off a study due to delays.
Were you surprised by the problems you encountered?
You know, I'm an active listener of your program, and I hear a lot of people use RVD, and they say it's fairly easy to use and fairly straightforward. And this is a young person. I would have thought I would not have had very much difficulty offering this to her.
Any questions for the faculty?
RVD is new for a lot of physicians. What's been your experience with neurological toxicities, with delayed cytopenias, with skin toxicity, with fatigue and tiredness?
Any specific questions about her case?
This is a low-risk patient by cytogenetics and by FISH. Does she really need a bortezomib-based induction regimen, which you do just as well, to get lenalidomide, thalidomide with steroids, and then go on to get a peripheral stem cell transplant? You know, if she had taken that option, or if she had been randomized to the lenalidomide alone option, she would have been long done with all of her treatment and be back on maintenance.
So, Bill, my ears were sort of burning a little bit when I talked to Dr. Fishkin. I thought of all the Dana-Farber people I've talked to who said, yeah, RVD, you know, not too difficult. Have you had patients like this with this kind of a problem? You can see pretty significant heterogeneity in how people approach the transplant-eligible patient. What's your experience with the triple regimens and this kind of problem?
Well, I think there's no question that some of the triple regimens are highly effective. You get rapid cytoreduction, rapid fall in monoclonal protein, but you do pay a price of increased toxicity. Now, RVD is certainly one of the newer regimens on the block, but it does have a not insignificant incidence of neurotoxicity, and I think you have to be very proactive about dose adjusting and being attuned to your patient's symptoms of neuropathy in order to avoid some of the problems. I think it seems like this physician was, in fact, very attuned to it, but despite that, this patient got into problems. One thing that'll be interesting, there is a presentation, I believe, on Tuesday looking at the administration of subcutaneous bortezomib. And this was a straightforward trial of IV versus sub-Q bortezomib in relapsed patients getting a combination of bortezomib and dex. The interesting thing about this trial is the incidence of neuropathy was reduced by 50%. And this may represent a new way to give this drug.
Ravi, any comments on the choice of initial therapy outside of protocol setting in the transplant-eligible patient?
I think you'll get as varied an answer as the number of physicians you have on a panel for this. I think that, once again, there is a move among thought leaders to develop the CHOP for myeloma. in terms of having deepening responses, higher CR rates in the upfront setting being surrogates for survival in most trials for myeloma. But I think we still don't know whether myeloma is going to follow the intermediate-grade lymphoma paradigm of CHOP Rituxan or be approached better as a low-grade lymphoma. I think in the transplant-eligible population, we do have some studies suggesting at least that VTD as a three-drug regimen has better CR rates and initially progression-free survival compared to two-drug regimens, and that is what is driving my use of three-drug regimens at the moment.
So, Mari, any comments about what happened with this patient?
Right. We're moving from science to philosophy here, and the real question that's being asked is that we increase the intensity of treatment in an ever-increasing effort to increase our depth of response. How do we balance these response rates against potential long-term toxicity and the impact on these patients' quality of life? When we talk to patients not on studies, we can talk to them about aggregate outcomes, 300 patients in one arm versus 300 patients in another arm. But that doesn't mean that we have a one-size-fits-all regimen that's right for every patient. And the big problem that we have is we're looking at lots of phase 2 trials, and we're looking at response rates in phase 2 trials, and you're asking us to draw conclusions across phase 2 trials that this one had a CR plus NCR rate of 35 and this one was 39, so maybe the 39 is better, except we have no idea whether that translates into survival because we don't have the phase 3 trials. The other thing has to do with the way in which we talk about toxicity at the podium. If I talk to you about grade 3, grade 4 neutropenia or thrombocytopenia, most of you, if you're like me, couldn't care less. That's going to get better in 3 or 4 days. I know how to take care of the neutropenia and the thrombocytopenia. It's not really a big deal to me. You start talking about grade 3, grade 4 neuropathy, we're talking now about patients who are going to be in a wheelchair and maybe won't get out of the wheelchair. Even when we talk about grade 2 neuropathy, we say, well, it's only grade 2. Well, grade 2 is defined by interferes with function. No, to me, that's a big deal. And so I get very, very concerned about 3 is better than 2, 4 is better than 3, but it depends on what your end point is. From my patient's standpoint, of course, they just want to live the longest possibility. That lady from Illinois needs to be able to feed those cattle. She's not going to be able to do it if she's in a walker or she has syncope when she stands up.
Let me just ask Bill, though, real quick. If this patient were to present to you today, what would your likely non-protocol therapy be, and what trial would you offer a patient like this?
Well, for a transplant-eligible patient, we currently have a trial that involves weekly bortezomib with weekly dexamethasone, weekly Cytoxan, and then once per cycle, pegylated doxorubicin. So it's a 4-drug regimen, but it's a weekly type schedule, 3 weeks out of 4. Off protocol, I would offer this patient bortezomib, thalidomide, dexamethasone, because while I think Mori is correct, we don't have direct randomized trials, I think the data after 3 or 4 cycles of VTD compared to VRD suggests that VTD is a more robust combination.
And does the trial, this is a local study or a national cooperative study?
The 4-drug, it's a local trial that we're doing in it. We have a consortium of community physicians who participate in the trial, so it's regional.
And what do you do about maintenance after transplant in those patients?
Well, maintenance is a separate issue, of course, and a very large issue.
But in terms of the trial?
This trial is only an induction trial.
So it's up to the investigator what you do afterwards?
So these are transplant-eligible patients, so the assumption is that many of these patients will go on to transplant. But the maintenance issue is an open question. Mori, this woman developed a leg ulcer, and I have to say I've personally never seen skin toxicity to that degree with these agents and wondered what you think of that.
Oh, it's difficult to know with certainty. You start wondering whether there might have been a deep venous thrombosis related to the lenalidomide and that resulted in a varicose ulcer. So you start wondering if the patient, due to sensory neuropathy, traumatized her extremity unbeknownst to her and that ulcerated. There's a lot of possibilities. But no, reported direct ulceration of the skin from either lenalidomide or bortezomib is not in my experience.
Before we get on to the next case, I just want to pick up a little bit more in terms of the shades of how people perceive the maintenance data. It's always tough for oncologists in practice to figure out what people really think about that. What about the ongoing clinical trials right now, Bill? I know a number of them have been altered to include maintenance as part of post-transplant therapy. Is this, you know, Mari put it up there, that doesn't affect survival. Is this a current standard of care?
Well, unfortunately, many of the current transplant trials, I think, have adopted maintenance as a standard in all arms without evaluating a placebo arm or even alternative maintenance strategies. I'm concerned because I don't think we know if there's truly a survival advantage. There is a cost, both financially and in terms of side effects of these drugs. Granted, lenalidomide has a low incidence of dropout, but patients do have side effects. There were more cytopenias with the drug in terms of maintenance. There were more infectious complications associated with the use of lenalidomide. So I think in the absence of compelling survival data, I think we have to be cautious about recommending maintenance as a standard of care after autologous transplant.
Mari, we see this situation so often in oncology. Certainly earlier on, you're going to see event-free survival in general in clinical trials. So tough to figure out. You got to factor in the toxicity. What are you doing right now in your own practice outside of protocol setting in terms of post-transplant maintenance?
Obviously, one could never criticize someone for using post-transplant maintenance. I personally think event-free survival is the wrong endpoint to use. I think all I care about is overall survival. And when the patient progresses, if they're lenalidomide naive, and I give them lenalidomide at the time of progression, and then the overall survival is the same, then I don't think it's that big a breakthrough.
Ravi, agree, disagree, or in between?
I tend to agree. I generally have not adopted maintenance for all patients. I'm doing it for patients who have residual disease detectable post-transplant. I agree that overall survival for maintenance therapy is the only endpoint which is meaningful.